Okay, so I'm going to talk today about topological properties of P plus IP paired states. So here's where we're going to start. So I want to talk about fermions in two dimensions. And I'll basically focus on zero temperature. Now, we've already heard a lot about superfluid states, paired states. We know lots of things about these. We have many interesting different things can occur in this system. I wonder how to focus this. I hope that's all right. So we know we have quantized vortices, textures. There are collective modes, excitations of the order parameter. In the paired fermion systems, there are BCS quasiparticles, which are unpaired fermions, broken pairs, if you like. And we've also heard a lot about the BCS to BEC crossover or transition in connection with the S-wave paired states. But there's a number of outstanding issues that we can still think about, and which are more the focus of this talk. So one issue is what happens for non-S-wave pairing with non-zero angular momentum for the pairs, for Cooper pairs. What changes? And a related and connected issue is statistics of excitations. For example, we've got these quantized vortices in the superfluid, or paired superfluid, and you might reasonably ask whether a vortex is a boson. Is a vortex a boson? Is it something else? Is it an anion? And so that will be one of the issues that I want to address. Okay. So although for the purpose of this talk, for this conference, I'm mainly going to focus on paired states of fermions in two dimensions, as you might make with cold atoms. I'll also mention here another area where same technology can be applied. These are quantum Hall states, and in fact these can also occur in cold atom systems. For example, rapidly rotating systems of bosons, still in two dimensions of course. The relevant regime involves a lowest lambda level where the effective magnetic field is H over the quantum length of the harmonic trap squared, the length in the two dimensions, that is. And then you can define a filling factor nu, which is the number of particles per vortices. By the way, this was really pioneered by our chairman, Mike Gunn and Nicola Wilkin. And then there was this very important paper of Cooper, Wilkin, and Gunn from 2001. And what they found here was that there seems to be a critical filling factor. This is the relevant parameter. And the vortex lattice melts below a value of this of about something like 6 to 10. When it melts, it forms some quantum fluid, quite different from the Bose condensate. And this is a quantum Hall state, or rather a sequence of quantum Hall states, because it depends critically on the filling factor. In particular, at nu equals 1, there's a paired state of a type that we pioneered some years back. And this can also be understood as a paired state of fermions in the following way, even though this is a system of bosons. The way to do that, which is a little intricate, but on the other hand, not really needed for this talk, but I'll just go over it rather quickly. The way you can do that is we take the wave function of the bosons, which is a symmetric function, and we write it, or we divide it by this factor, which is a pure phase factor written in terms of the complex coordinates of the particles in the 2D plane. So it's a factor which winds as by 2 pi as any particle goes right around another particle. Okay. Taking this factor out, the function that's left, you can see, is anti-symmetric. And so, at least formally, this describes fermions. And then you can do some mean field stuff involving this phase factor and so-called Chern-Simons gauge field. And I really wish I could focus this projector. So there's an effective, thank you, that's great, Chern-Simons magnetic field, which is proportional to the density. And if we're working at filling factor 1, this cancels this magnetic field that we had up here, which represents the effect of the rotation. And so through this mapping, we've mapped the problem onto something of fermions in zero net magnetic field. And then we can consider the possibility of pairing of these spinless fermions. And in fact, that's what seems to actually happen in numerics and leads to a trial state. So the things that I'm going to describe now in more detail for p-wave pairing can also be applied in this quantum Hall system of bosons at filling factor 1, and also, by the way, in the quantum Hall effect of electrons at filling factor 5/2. Which is seen experimentally and may be the same state. Okay. So now let's forget about quantum Hall for some time and just go back to pairing of fermions. So we're going to consider just spinless or spin polarized fermions. And we make the standard BCS kind of mean field approximation to describe a condensate, or at least to look for whether a condensate will form, which involves decoupling the interaction by replacing part of it. I suppose I should add the Hermitian conjugate here, I forgot. But we replace part of some of the field operators, CK, by their expectation value, call this whole combination the gap function delta K, and then we are left with this term, which is still an operator, which creates two particles with opposite wave vectors K. So here, for the time being, I'm working in a translationally invariant situation where I can actually make use of momentum eigenstates for the particles. So the first thing that we need to do is we should, having made this approximation, we can solve this Hamiltonian, which is now a quadratic in these operators. We have to solve this. After we've solved it, what we're supposed to do is use the resulting ground state to calculate this expectation value and thus calculate delta K, and then we have to self-consist. We have to make the whole thing self-consistent so that we actually have a solution for delta K, which might turn out to be zero, or it could turn out to be non-zero. So a notation here is psi K is the kinetic energy, K squared over twice the mass, minus the chemical potential. And then we have delta K and delta K star in these terms, as I mentioned. And because of the Fermi statistics of the particles here, and because they're spinless, delta K has to be an odd function of K. And I'm going to assume the simplest case of a P wave, which is L is actually minus 1 here. And I'm going to assume a particular form of P wave, which is this PX actually minus I PY is the convention I like to use. There are actually two possible ordered states. I'm just considering one of them. And that's an issue we might have to come back to. And this is also supposed to go to zero at infinity. Okay. So I'm going to just walk you through the solution of this to bring out the salient points. Okay, so the normalized ground state of BCS takes this form, basically the same as already mentioned yesterday by Wolfgang Kepler, except now we don't have spin. And so each pair K and minus K can only appear once in this product. To make it normalized, the UKs and VKs have to obey this condition. And to solve for this, it's useful to introduce quasi-particle operators, which are linear combinations of CK and C minus K dagger. And these are operators alpha K and alpha K dagger, which diagonalize the energy. So these create energy eigenstates, which have energies EK. And alpha K is the one which annihilates the ground state. Okay, so the ground state with EK, all the EK is positive or non-negative. This state omega is in fact the ground state, and all the other states have higher energy. And so the conditions on the coefficients for this to work are a set of equations called the, more generally called the Sogolyubov-Dejean equation, which here is just a 2x2 matrix equation for each k. Okay, so this is easy to solve, and the solution for EK and for the U's and V's basically looks like this. And now we can examine what happens near K is zero. So first of all, for K is zero, EK at zero, because delta K vanishes, EK is just mod mu at K is zero. And so this goes to zero at the point mu equals zero. Okay, now we also heard yesterday about positive mu and negative mu in the context of pairing. And let me remind you that negative values of mu below the bottom of the band, so to speak, are perfectly okay in the presence of pairing because you have an attractive interaction. So it's perfectly possible to have a negative value of chemical potential and still have particles in the system when you have an attractive interaction. And I'm basically doing all this, by the way, at fixed density or fixed average number of particles. So that's perfectly okay. Okay, so this goes to zero at mu equals zero, and k is zero. And if we just expand around small mu and k, we get this relativistic form of dispersion relation for ek, which is a hyperbolic dispersion that's supposed to be represented here. So this has the same form for non-zero mu, whether it's positive or negative. In fact, there's only one type of quasiparticle for each k, and the antiparticle of a quasiparticle of wave vector k is just a quasiparticle of wave vector minus k. So these particles are their own antiparticles. The Bogoliubov-Dejean equation reduces to the Dirac equation. So these are really Dirac fermions, but with this extra condition that they're their own antiparticles, they become so-called Majorana fermions. Okay. So what we see, is, in fact, then, is that there's a phase transition that occurs at mu is zero, where the excitation gap for the fermions goes to zero. There's a corresponding diverging length scale, 1 over mod mu. And it's the nature of this transition that we want to understand. In particular, there's no obvious order parameter for this phase transition. Okay. So if we fix the average density, decreasing mu corresponds to a stronger attractive interaction. Okay. So if mu is close to but just below the Fermi energy for a given density, this is the BCS regime of weak coupling, weak attractive interaction. If as mu goes to minus infinity, this is what happens in the BEC regime of tightly bound of condensation of tightly bound bosonic pairs. So we're really discussing again the crossover between these two regimes, but in fact in this case it's not a crossover; it's an actual phase transition. And so because these are connected to the weak coupling and strong coupling limits, I'll call the mu positive phase the weak pairing phase and the mu negative phase the strong pairing phase. So this does not necessarily mean the coupling has to be weak, just that these are the same phase. Weak pairing includes the weak coupling limit, but close to mu is zero, the coupling is actually quite strong of some intermediate strength. So one way to distinguish these two phases is to look at the behavior of U and V. You find as k goes to zero that in the weak pairing phase, mod UK goes to zero as k goes to zero, while mod VK goes to one. In the strong pairing phase, it's the reverse. And there's different behavior if you're right at the transition point mu is zero. Okay. So now to get further insight into the difference between these, let's look at the wave function of the ground state. So this can be rewritten the expression I had before can be rewritten in this as an exponential of bilinears, as again Ketterly mentioned yesterday. And this important function gk here then is therefore the ratio of vk over uk. Then we can extract from this the position space wave function for n particles, or the components of the wave function for n particles, in this way. And what we get is, well, it involves the Fourier transform of this gk, which is called g of r. And it's, we have terms which simply represent the pairs. So this is the Bose condensate of pairs, if you like. G of r1 minus r2 is a pair, product of all those. But then we have to anti-symmetrize over all the permutations that give distinct pairings of the particles. So actually, if we take a fixed set of positions, ri, then this is referred to as the Pfaffian of a matrix. G of ri minus rj is a set of matrix elements of an n by n matrix, and this is the Pfaffian of the matrix. Sometimes you might hear of that. Okay. So if you look at this behavior of this in the two cases, first the strong pairing phase. In the strong pairing phase, gk is just a real analytic in the vicinity of k is zero. In fact, if it's real analytic everywhere in k space, then it just, in real space, it just falls exponentially with distance. I guess I've tended to leave out the, of course, it still has to have p-wave symmetry, which I've left out here. Anyway, it falls exponentially. So these are obviously strongly bound pairs. But in the weak pairing phase, it's different, because now uk goes as kx plus iky for small k, and gk now diverges at small k with this form. And then if you take the Fourier transform, you find that g of r has this long tail behaving as 1 over the complex coordinate z. So there's a long tail in the pairing function here. There's a sense in which these really are rather weakly bound, because there's a long tail in this function. And this is true throughout the weak pairing phase. Finally, if we just sit right at the transition point, mu is zero, we get intermediate behavior, 1 over z mod z. So if we take this, the asymptotic behavior here from the weak pairing phase, and just take that for all z and stick it into the Pfaffian, this expression is part of our quantum Hall state from years back. Okay. Well, doesn't really appear, but yeah. I mean, just a parameter in my it was only a parameter in my effective Hamiltonian anyway. Yeah. You can still have the strong pairing phase in principle in quantum Hall. We just never seem to see it. It could exist. Okay. So now we want to go a bit further with certain things I'm going to get to in a minute. So for this, we want to look at the Bogoliubov-Dejean equation in position space. So we're going to simplify. Psi k is minus mu near k is 0. And delta k, we can Fourier transform and also generalize a bit. And because it's linear in k, small k, it becomes this differential operator, d by dx minus I d by dy. And then in general, we could have a complex function, delta hat of r, in here as well. And we need to symmetrize over the two orderings of these factors to make this a Hermitian differential operator. Okay. I'll also call this combination twice d by dz, or simply twice d. And in fact, although it's not obvious, this operator is gauge covariant under a gauge transformation. If you look at it rather carefully, you find that it's gauge covariant. Okay, so then the Bogoliubov-Dejean equation in position space, if we we were doing some more general version of our pairing problem then with a with this given function, or actually operator, then takes this form. So this is an anticommutator of the d or d bar and this function delta of r or delta of r complex conjugate. So if we take the function delta hat to be a constant, then we do just get the Dirac equation in position space. So in general, this function delta hat has to be determined by something like Landau-Ginzburg or Gross-Pitayski theory. Although that really deals with the condensate as a whole, it's not entirely obvious if this part of this function, which is connected with the small k behavior in the momentum space picture, is exactly what's determined by that equation. But there's presumably some fairly close connection between them. And in particular, the magnitude of delta hat may not always be constant in the neutral superfluid, for reasons that I'll mention more explicitly later. On the other hand, in the quantum Hall system or in charge superfluids, where you have a vector potential coupled to the order parameter, delta hat will be constant outside of various defects, such as vortices, that is, further than a penetration depth or coherence length from the core of the vortex, it will go to a constant. Okay, so as a first application of this, let's look at what happens on the edge of a droplet of P plus IP superfluid. So I'm really interested in properties that occur in the spectrum of these fermion quasi-particle excitations and not the other kinds of things. So we'll look at the Bogoliubov-Degen equation in this context. And I'm just going to assume the simplest case that delta hat of R is constant. It's the same for all R, even as we go outside the droplet here. And using a suggestion by Jason Ho, actually, we'll model the edge as a domain wall. So since we have two phases, we would expect that outside the drop, we have the vacuum. And this should really be, this is really the trivial phase, which should correspond to strong pairing, in fact. So we would imagine that mu is effectively negative outside the droplet, and positive inside. So we have a domain wall between the two phases. Incidentally, if you're worried about how mu can vary in position, mu is not really the chemical potential, which ought to be constant everywhere in space. Mu is really something that includes could include the potential, that is, the confining potential for the fermions in the trap. And so that's why mu, in fact, and then you can easily see that mu will be negative outside, sufficiently far outside here. Okay. And since delta hat is constant, this is just the Dirac equation that we have to solve here in the presence of this position-dependent mass term, mu, is the mass in the Dirac equation. So basically, the states, there are many states associated with the interior and even the exterior of the drop, which are still gapped. But what happens is there's a gapless Majorana fermion mode which propagates around the edge of the droplet, that is, along the domain wall. So in terms of the radial coordinate, which I've foolishly plotted from right to left here, okay, R is increasing to the left, mu is positive out. I've still messed it up, haven't I? It's just mu is should be positive inside, and mu is negative outside. So R is actually plotting from left to right. So there's a domain wall profile anyway at the edge here. And in the radial variable, there's a bound state wave function. As a function of the radial coordinate, u of x is localized on the domain wall. But it still has some angle dependence in general, and there's a set of modes which have a spectrum given by this. The energy Em, that should be, is mod delta hat times m over the radius r. And m takes half integer positive values, 1/2, 3/2, 5/2, and so on. So that's kind of the angular momentum of the fermion on the edge. So this mode propagates counterclockwise around the edge. And it exists in the when the interior of the drop is in the weak pairing phase, but not if the interior of the drop is in the strong pairing phase. Okay, so now we come to the vortices. So one way to think about a vortex is that you could think of it as a small circular domain wall. You could think of, take the previous picture and turn it inside out and make the circular domain wall rather small so that we have a weak pairing phase outside the vortex, and in the center we effectively have a vacuum or strong pairing phase. So it's vacuum, if you like, because centrifugal effects drive the fermions out of the center of the vortex. And so that's like the region outside the droplet. Okay, so a vortex, we usually think of a vortex as the order parameter delta hat winding in phase by 2 pi as you go around the vortex. Okay, I'm going to make a singular gauge transformation again and gauge away that phase. When I do that, the gauge transformation I need is not single-valued acting on the fermion fields. So now, although delta hat is constant, now the boundary condition on the fermion fields, or the functions u and v I want to solve for, are that these change sign as you go around the vortex. Okay. So again, the simplest version to solve is the case where delta hat is now just a constant, which is possible after this gauge transformation. And then we're back to the Dirac equation, and the only thing that, we would still have this domain wall here. But I would like to use, in fact, an alternative approach that I've been thinking about more recently, in which we take delta hat and mu constant outside the center of the vortex, which I just treat as a point. So this is what I would really like to do. I'd yet like to use this long wavelength description everywhere except down to a point in the middle of the vortex. And then I have to include the microscopic physics somehow, which should be a boundary condition at the point r is zero. And so in this case, I just have the Dirac equation with these constant parameters, and the only thing that makes it a vortex is that the u and v's are not single-valued on going around the vortex. But I also need some boundary conditions in the radial direction, and it turns out that we want to make the Dirac operator that appears in our Boglibov-Degen equation self-adjoint so that we really have a proper Hamiltonian. It turns out that there are just two choices of boundary conditions that are compatible with this Majorana condition and make it self-adjoint, and they're given here. So the point is that they're allowed to diverge as an inverse square root of distance. They've got sort of the obvious angular dependence, and there's a relative phase between the two components, and there are just two ways you're allowed to choose that. So this gives you two types of vortices. And the microscopics tells us that for our problem, we just want to pick one of those two types. And this type of vortex then, it turns out there's now an exact zero mode bound on the vortex in the weak pairing phase, but none in the strong pairing phase. And above this zero mode, there's a gap to all of the other fermion excitations. Well, you might want to go on and consider what happens if you have many vortices. If you have little n vortices in the weak pairing phase, you get one operator, one Majorana operator per vortex. So these correspond to these zero modes, which are still zero modes if the vortices are extremely far apart. You really have these degenerate states in the spectrum. Well, how many states are there exactly? Well, if we have an even number n of vortices from these Majorana operators which obey a reality condition, they're self-adjoint, we can form these complex combinations in a rather standard way. And these fermion operators F, there are only n over 2 of these operators F. They obey the usual canonical anti-commutation relations. And so that it follows that there's exactly 2 to the n over 2 states according to how we occupy these zero modes on the vortices. Actually, because these change the particle number, if you want to do it at fixed particle number, it's 2 to the n over 2 minus 1. And you can see from these Bogoliubov-Degen equations that the degeneracy of these states that differ by creating or destroying these fermions, the degeneracy is exact in the limit of large separation, but when the separation is finite, the splittings, which are of the order of e to the, well, they're exponentially small, with a length scale, which is again determined by the mass mod mu. And so it also is kind of clear that these degenerate states will persist if you deform the function delta hat of R. As you continuously deform it, these states in the spectrum can't just suddenly disappear. They have to evolve continuously, but they also have to stay at zero energy. And so they can't disappear unless you go to the phase transition to the strong pairing phase or through some other phase transition.
Is there apparent arbitrariness in how you associate Mercurial and Fermion? Are there better or worse ways to do it when you go through the phase
transition? Quite possibly.
Yeah,
I see. So when they're far apart, then there's an obvious way to associate these with each vortex. There's a basis where you do that, but that's not a basis of energy eigenstates when they're close together. Yeah. So what I want to emphasize here actually is that this is an amazing number of states to get. Now you might think, well, it's okay. It's just some internal state on each vortex, kind of like some spin or something. And you just got all those states. Well, that's not quite right, because that would give you 2 to the n states, right? Factor of 2 states for each vortex would be 2 to the n. This is not 2 to the n, this is 2 to the n over 2. So these degenerate states are not really locally constructed in space. When the vortices are far apart, each of those fermion modes, F here, is shared between 2 vortices. Okay. So if you imagine storing information in these states, the information is stored in a very, very non-local fashion in the states. Nonetheless, there are perfectly local operators, gamma I here, that are local, and all of the equations are local, so the physics is perfectly okay, but it's possible to have this non-local storage of information in the states. This is why this is of interest for topological quantum computation. Well, if you inject it near one of the vortices, you make some coherent state, which is not an eigenstate. You make a linear combination of states that are, you know, built out of modes near that vortex. And then you'd have to watch it evolve. Well, some of it's going to run off because of the non-bound states. So it's a rather complicated process. Okay. So that's the basic reason why these things are exciting. Now let's look at statistics. So first let me go back to something slightly different, which is again quantum Hall states. So I'm sort of banking on you being somewhat familiar with the Laughlin states in the quantum Hall effect, which written in terms of complex coordinates again, have this simple product form. The Laughlin factor here, kind of Jastrow factor, and then there are these factors which we can think of as describing the vortices, where the Wi's are coordinates of the vortices. Okay, so this is actually back in the gauge where the wave function does wind by 2 pi as Zi goes around a vortex. And then what we want to do is we want to adiabatically exchange these vortices. This is the correct way to define statistics of these objects. And it's correct for one thing because it's gauge invariant. It doesn't depend on the choices of a phase factor. depending on W that you might multiply in here, defined in a gauge invariant way. And by when you exchange these W1 with W2 here, for example, adiabatically, you eventually come back to the same state up to a phase. So it's meaningful, and there's a gauge invariant way to compare the state you had initially with the state you have in the end, and to see if they differ by a phase. And it turns out that the phase that you get skipping all of the intermediate steps, this was, by the way, originally done by Arova, Schrieffer, and Wilczek, actually here in on this campus in 1984 or so. And the phase that you get is basically something like e to the 2 pi I times the integral of the interior over the interior of the density of particles. Okay, and it's sort of because you get a factor of e to the 2 pi I for each zi, each w goes around the particle, and you get a phase factor e to the 2 pi I. Now that's not quite right because you have to do it in little tiny steps and pick it up, but nonetheless that gives you the right idea. So in the quantum Hall situation, the density of particles is constant on a scale more than, say, the particle separation, except that there's a little bit missing in the center of each vortex. And so you get a phase factor, which you can write as basically the area times some constant involving the filling factor, and an additional defect, e to the I pi over m. M is this exponent here. And this e to the I pi over m is the fractional statistics of the vortices, or quasi-particles. But this is because the density here is fixed, and you can actually extract this area factor like this so that you get a well-defined number. Now, suppose, on the other hand, you want to talk about vortices in helium. Then you would have to delete this Laughlin factor from the wave function, and you'd have something like these vortex factors left. Or you might want to modify that a bit further. The problem now is the density in helium is not fixed. It's a compressible fluid. And in fact, from a hydrodynamic calculation, you find that the density profile of one vortex, the density at distance r from the center, it goes to a constant, and then there's the correction, which is a negative constant divided by distance. Okay, and so if you try to do this kind of integral for this, you're getting a log. Maybe I mean r squared here, but anyway, you get a it doesn't converge to any definite number here. Now, this was pointed out by Haldane and Wu in 1985. So it means that even at zero temperature, vortices in a helium film do not have a well-defined statistics parameter, not even as anions. Just not even, it's not even a well-defined concept, really. Okay. So that's a compressible superfluid, and you might well expect the same should happen in paired fermion superfluids. And although we don't have a lot of detail, we think that this is what happens. In particular, the hydrodynamics of a paired superfluid is quite similar to the hydrodynamics of a ordinary Bose superfluid. On the other hand, it does not happen in the paired quantum Hall states because, like the Laughlin states, they're incompressible fluids. It also doesn't happen in the case of charged superconductors. If you'll allow me to make a two-dimensional version of it with sufficiently long-range interactions, then there are screening effects so that the density outside a vortex should go to a constant and does not have this slow fall-off. In those cases, there would be well-defined abelian, phase factor effects in those cases. But now, in our weak pairing phase of P plus IP, we also have non-abelian statistics effects. So that is that when we adiabatically exchange two of these vortices, again, there's a well-defined meaning to an operation. And because there's a degenerate set of states, if they're very far apart, we've got a small vector space of dimension 2 to the n over 2 minus 1. And the effect of an exchange is a matrix operation in that space. And we know what matrices those should be. And because the matrices for different exchanges don't commute, it's referred to as non-abelian, and this is called non-abelian statistics. So recently we were able to, in some work with Nigel Cooper, we were able to show this explicitly for these functions, at least for the functions that we get by taking delta hat constant. should mention that there's earlier results which are perhaps partial results because they don't quite get the full matrix effect here. They get it modulo a phase factor. Okay. So this is a really exciting effect, and again, it's the basis for topological quantum computation. In terms of these neutral superfluids, P plus IP states, you would need to be able to ignore or throw away the rather poorly defined phase factors that I had on the last slide in order to get at this matrix action. Okay, so now I have come to my conclusions. So the weak and strong pairing phases are both topological phases, albeit the strong pairing phase is the trivial topological phase. There's no obvious order parameter for the behavior of the, well, of the fermion sector, that is, to distinguish the two phases, although, of course, both paired states have the usual order parameter of the paired superfluid, but I'm talking about an order parameter that would distinguish the two phases. They can be distinguished by looking at things like topology in K-space, which I didn't mention actually explicitly. And they can be distinguished by looking at the low-lying excitations, such as the behavior of the fermion modes on the edge, which are quite different in the two phases. And these, all of these properties are robust against perturbations. On the other hand, the compressibility of the fluid may be an issue in trying to look for some of these effects in the neutral superfluid paired systems. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Okay, question.
Nick, I wonder, could you clarify what you said about logarithmic corrections to braiding vortices in helium-3? I was under the impression that Moore-Reed quasi-particles were expected in helium-3A.
Helium-3, I'm not so familiar with all of the details about helium-3, actually, but there are supposed to be some type of one of these rather exotic texture excitation type of vortices, even in that case, which has spin, which may have the same kind of statistics. But that's really focusing on the fermion sector, as I was describing, and I think it's ignoring this effect of the compressible density excitations. One of the reasons I wanted to emphasize it is I think people may be a bit unaware of this aspect. I believe so, yes. Yes, I mean also, you know, the spin textures that may be involved there also behave like compressible fluids, so you'd have the same kind of issues. Yeah. I think you need a mic, hold on.
Oh, sorry, I'm gonna just comment. I thought helium-3 is, I don't know you're referring to the case of the A phase, for example, that is not a spin polarized situation.
No.
In the A1 phase, it has, but I guess this system that Nick talked about is very specific for two dimension, and for three dimension, then the mode may not exactly at the zero, at the zero mode. So.
Okay, but we're talking about a film of helium-3. I believe it's the A phase, but then there's some other funny type of vortex you can have, some half flux, it's even smaller flux than the usual vortex.
Yeah, well, as I say, the helium, but for the A phase, there are two spin populations.
Yeah.
But here you consider a case of completely spin polarized.
Yeah, yeah. So Ivanov has a paper where he says that you can have this behavior in. So don't blame me.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments? Okay, if not, then maybe we could aim to get back about 11:10 for the next session.